Fascinating and very adaptive critters. Reefs, bays, entrances to rivers can affect the damage, the slope of the beach. The waves can crest to 100 feet or more, but mostly, they just surge. All depends on what's in the way. They can wrap around a headland and cause damage on the opposite side of an island. When they get squeezed, they become really dangerous because you've got all that intensity built up in a small space. He pointed out the window at a river that fed into the harbor. The high banks were littered with debris. They can even go up rivers, as they did here. Good thing the condos Jack Schrager built on the banks of the river weren't occupied. There'd be a lot of dead people floating around in that harbor instead of scraps of wood. Damned lucky you saw those waves and recognized their threat. More than lucky. Jenkins clicked his computer mouse and pulled up a map of the world with arrows pointing to various countries. In the decades starting in 1990, tsunamis killed more than 400 people and caused billions of dollars in damage. He tapped the screen. This one in Papua New Guinea was a real horror. The wave was 45 feet tall when it hit along 19 miles of coast. A few minutes later, there were more than 200 people dead. He switched over to a simulation. This is an animation of a quake-generated wave attacking a Japanese village back in 1923. You see a lot of big waves in the Pacific. It's surrounded by the Rim of Fire, all those tectonic plates that shift every so often. Hate to be so parochial, but we're talking the Atlantic, not the Pacific, and the coast of Maine, not Japan. I've lived here all my life, and I've yet to hear about a quake. You've probably had more minor tremors than you know of, but I agree. That's why I started thinking about other causes. Tsunamis caused by landslides are less common. Then you've got volcanic eruptions and large meteorites. Not too many volcanoes around here that I know of. Be grateful. The Krakatoa volcano created waves 100 feet high and killed thousands back in 1883. If an asteroid 5 miles across landed in the mid-Atlantic, it would create a wave high enough to swamp the upper east coast of the U.S. New York would be wiped off the map. That leaves landslide. It's what we call a slump. Here, let me show you. Jenkins pulled up another map on the monitor. This is İzmit Bay in Turkey. They had a slump-generated wave there that caused extensive damage. What caused the slump? An earthquake. Jenkins chuckled. I know, it's like asking which came first, the chicken or the egg. In general, a slump is caused by a quake. That's the problem with our Rocky Cove ripple. There was a slump, but no quake. Are you sure? Absolutely. I've talked to the folks at the Weston Observatory in Massachusetts. They keep tabs on all seismic disturbances in the area. They picked up some rumbles that indicated a slump, but no quake preceding it, as I'd expect. I heard a tremendous underwater boom shortly before I saw things happening. There was apparently a movement of ocean bottom east of Maine, but without the normal crash of tectonic plates. I've talked to tsunami experts all around the country. Nobody has heard of such a thing. Then we're stumped. Not exactly. Jenkins brought the wave profile back onto the computer screen. I've put together a simulation of our wave. It's pretty crude. Even with the best information, wave calculations can be complicated. You've got to factor in stuff like velocity, wave height, and destructive force. And you've got all the coastal features that cause a wave to deflect or diffract. You've got to calculate the effects of backwash from following waves. Sounds impossible. It nearly is, but not totally. A few years ago, scientists used computer-based mathematical modeling techniques to solve the demise of the civilization on Crete. Look, this is a map chart of the main coast. That's the harbor. The hardest hit was several miles from here, where some fishermen saw waves breaking over Newcomb's rocks. The chief whistled. Those cliffs must be 50 feet high. Jenkins nodded and indicated the chart on the screen. An arrow pointed toward the land. The main wave force was just to the north of here, so even with my warning, things could have been worse here at the cove. I don't even know if this house would have been safe. The chief went pale. That would have been the whole town. Jenkins leaned forward and peered at the computer. This is amazing. Look at how straight it came in. Almost like a child creating a wave in a bathtub. The chief tapped the screen. Is this where it started? Yeah. It's only an estimate built on circumstantial evidence. I took a course in accident reconstruction. It's amazing what you can tell about speed and impact from skid marks and broken headlights. I'm pretty confident that it originated about 150 miles to the east. What are you going to do now? Jenkins' shoulders ached from tension. First, I'm going to brew up some tea. Then we're going to have us a slam-bang game of chess. Chapter 13. The Black Sea. As the fishing boat Turgut approached the Russian coast, Austin swept the deserted shoreline through the lenses of his Fujinon gyro-stabilized binoculars, alert to any feature out of sync with its surroundings. The barren coast seemed peaceful. Wind and tide had scrubbed the sand clean of footprints. Green tufts of new growth sprouted in the fire-blackened patches of dune grass. It was hard to imagine the deadly game he had played over this tranquil setting only days before. The beach was about a mile wide, flanked by two headlands like the arms of a sofa, except for the cliff sculpted by wind and sea into the sharp profile of an old man. The shoreline was unremarkable. A misty curtain hung over the dunes. Austin remembered that the land hidden behind the grassy ridge sloped down to the abandoned buildings, then flattened out in a scraggly plain edged by woods, gradually rising to low rolling hills. A smell like burning rope assaulted Austin's nostrils. Wrinkling his nose, he lowered the stethoscope and turned to see Captain Kamal. The captain removed the twisted black cigar from between his tobacco-stained teeth and jabbed it toward the shore. How does it look, Mr. Austin? As quiet as a grave, Captain. I don't think I like it quiet like that. He exhaled twin streams of smoke through his crooked nose. When I smuggled, I never liked a beach that was calm like this. Not even birds flying. You sure you want to go there now? Unfortunately, we don't have much choice. I was hoping the fog would burn off, though. Kamal squinted toward shore. Another hour. Two, maybe. That's too long. We'll move soon. The captain waved his cigar in the air, discharging a shower of sparks. The men are ready when you say. Austin nodded, thinking about the conversation he'd had with Kamal on the trip from Istanbul. Austin had asked the captain if he knew the Russian sailor who'd sold Kael Adorn the map that led her to the subbase. His name is Valentin, the captain had replied with no hesitation. The other fishermen use him when they need an extra hand. Miss Dorn paid him too much money for this big secret, he said with a sad shake of his head. All the fishermen knew about the submarines. People knew there was a base there? Sure. Kamal's thin lips had widened in a knowing grin. Fishermen know everything. We watch the weather, the water, birds, other boats. He tapped the corner of an eye with his forefinger. If you don't keep a lookout, you're going to be in trouble. Kamal's revelation was no surprise to Austin. He often worked with fishermen on Numa assignments and found them to be keen observers of conditions under, on, and above the sea. A fisherman had to be a combination biologist, meteorologist, mechanic, and mariner. Their livelihood, their very lives, depended on their store of practical knowledge. As a former smuggler, Kamal would have been more vigilant than the average mariner. How long did you fish these waters? Austin asked. Many years. In the old days, you would see many boats from all over, Turkish, Russian, sometimes even Bulgarian. The fishing is good. Big schools of bonito come in close to feed. Nobody bothers us. Then one day, the Russians come with patrol boats and men with machine guns. They tell the fishermen this is a science station. They will kill anyone who gets too close. Some fishermen didn't believe them and got shot, so the rest of us stayed away. We work offshore, where nobody bothers us. Sometimes the fishermen see periscopes. Once, a big black fin came up near my boat. A submarine conning tower? He wanted to look, I guess, Kemal said with a nod. Then Russia falls apart. The submarines stop coming. Everyone says the Russian Navy is broke. One day, I take a chance. I follow a school of fish in close. He held an invisible steering wheel in his hand to demonstrate. I'm ready to run if they come. But nobody stops me. Since then, I fish here with no trouble. He shrugged. When the television people want to go in with Mehmet, I think it's no big deal. Did you ever go ashore and look around? No. What's there was not my business. That was before Mehmet got shot. He spat over the side. Now it is my business. Kemal's story meshed with the report Austin's friend Leahy had sent him. According to the CIA files, construction on the base started in the 1950s. A U-2 plane photographed the site on an overflight. The U.S. kept close tabs on the growing complex. The Turkish counterpart of the CIA confirmed the reports of submarine traffic. U.S. listening posts determined that the base was under the command of the Black Sea Fleet at Sevastopol. The scientific station was built to do ocean research that would help the fleet do its job. Military activity slowed after the Cold War. The cash-strapped new Russian Republic shut the base down, much as obsolete army installations were closed in the U.S. The scientific station was abandoned. The CIA could have saved millions in surveillance expense by talking to Kemal and his friends. Unfortunately, the one point on which the Turk was wrong, his belief that the base was deserted, had cost his cousin's life. When the Turgut was less than a mile from shore, Austin asked the captain to drop anchor. Kemal yelled an order to his crew, and a minute later the boat coasted to a stop and vibrated with the rattle of the anchor chain. As the anchor splashed into the sea, Kemal excused himself and went off to supervise the setting of the trawls. Zavala appeared from the other side of the boat, where he had been getting their scuba gear ready for a dive. Austin eyed the twisted stub of the cheroot clenched between Zavala's teeth. I see you've been raiding the captain's humidor. He insisted. I didn't want to hurt his feelings. Zavala removed the stogie from his mouth and held it at arm's length. I think they make these things out of old tires, but I'm sort of getting used to the taste, he said with a shrug. Gear's all set to go. Austin followed Zavala to the port side, where the wheelhouse hid them from prying eyes on the mainland. Neatly laid out on the narrow deck were two rows of double air tanks, weight belts, hoods, gloves, boots, and fins, and two black Viking Pro dry suits manufactured to NATO specifications. Sunlight glinted off the yellow fiberglass housings of two Torpedo 2000 driver propulsion vehicles. Mounted in tandem, the dual rocket-shaped, battery-powered vehicles had a top speed of 5 miles an hour and a running time of an hour. They shimmied into their dive suits, helped each other on with their air tanks, and did a buddy equipment inspection. Then they waddled to the rail with the shuffling walk divers use out of water and stood at the edge of the deck. "Any questions before we plunge in?" Austin said. Zavala flicked the black cigar stub over the side. Plan the dive and dive the plan. Get in, take a look, get out. Stay flexible. Improvise when necessary. Zavala's succinct summation could have applied to any mission Austin led. Austin was a staunch believer in simplicity of execution because the more elements in a plan, the greater the chance for a screw-up. He knew from experience that it was impossible to anticipate every situation when the details were sparse. His muscular body was marked with scars that were stark reminders that even the most carefully laid scheme could unravel in the face of the unexpected. As insurance, though, they carried guns and extra ammunition in their chest packs. They also had communications equipment, although it would be of limited value. They were invading the soil of a foreign country. If he and Zavala encountered trouble, they were on their own. "You forgot one thing," Austin said. Zavala looked behind him. "Cover your ass?" "CYA is always a good idea. But what I was thinking was this. We're not Mission Impossible. We're not the Suicide Squadron. We're simply a couple of nosy guys who want to come back, preferably with our skin in one piece." "That suits me fine," Zavala said. "I'm very attached to my skin." Austin winced at Zavala's joke and gave the captain the thumbs-up sign. He held onto his mask and chest pack so they wouldn't fly up, and jumped fin-first into the dark blue sea, sinking several feet before his automatic buoyancy control lifted him back to the surface. Zavala bobbed up a few feet away. As they floated in the mild swell, they made sure their regulators were working. Then Austin signaled Kamal. The captain lowered the bright yellow torpedo 2000s down to the water. The crewmen were setting trawls on the land side. From shore, the Turgut looked like any other fishing boat harvesting the sea. Austin reminded Kamal to keep his radio on and to leave quickly at the first sign of trouble. He didn't want more funerals in the captain's family. Kamal gave him a smile that showed he had no intention of following Austin's advice, and wished them good luck in Turkish and in English. Austin bit down on his regulator mouthpiece, folded his body in a surface dive, and with a flip of his fins, disappeared below the surface. Zavala was only a moment behind. At 20 feet, they hovered and tested their voice-activated dive-link wireless underwater communication system. "Ready to invade Russia?" Austin asked. "Can't wait," Zavala said, sounding like Donald Duck in Austin's earphones. "Russia has some of the most beautiful women in the world. Green eyes, high cheekbones, lush lips. Keep a lid on your raging libido, Jose. This isn't Club Med we're going to. When we get home, you can order a Russian bride over the internet. Thanks for dashing cold water on my lustful thoughts. Speaking of cold water, we've got about a mile of this stuff ahead of us, so I suggest we get moving." Austin checked his wrist compass and jerked his thumb toward shore. They flicked on the switches of their propulsion vehicles, the battery-powered motors hummed into life, and the Torpedo 2000s surged ahead, smoothly pulling the divers through the pale green water. Their approach sent schools of fish flying off to either side, making it evident why Kamal and his fellow fishermen had risked their necks to work these waters. Near the surf line, the water became turbid from floating particles of vegetation kicked up by the crashing waves. Austin angled the Torpedo 2000 down to the sandy sea bottom, with Zavala a few feet behind him. "Any idea what we're looking for?" Zavala said, squinting toward the gravelly banking that rose sharply from the seafloor to meet the beach. "A neon sign saying this is it would help, but I'll settle for something that looks like a big garage door." Zavala switched on his powerful phantom dive light and played the bullseye across the slope. "I don't even see a doorknob." "We're wasting our time here. They wouldn't build on the beach. They'd want solid rock over their heads. Let's check out the cliffs. I'll take the one to the right." Zavala waved, and with the ease of a natural pilot, he put his propulsion vehicle in a graceful turn and shot off, quickly disappearing into the murk. Austin headed in the opposite direction. A moment later, the voice of a singing duck filled Austin's earphones as Zavala rendered an off-tune version of Guantanamera. Austin moved parallel to the undersea embankment until the sand and gravel gave over to solid rock. Zavala's quacking became fainter as they expanded their range. Austin was grateful for this development, but he didn't want too much space separating them. He saw nothing that resembled an entrance and was about to tell Zavala to head back, but Joe broke off his serenade with a loud Whoa! Say again. Got something, Kurt, he said excitedly. Austin wheeled the Torpedo 2000 around in a tight arc. He glided past the beach and homed in on a silvery pinpoint that blinked like a firefly on a summer night. Zavala was hovering at mid-water and flashing his light as a homing beacon. When Austin got closer, Zavala adjusted his light to flood pattern and pointed the beam toward the face of the undersea wall that rose to become the chin of Imam's Point. Austin was looking at a huge pile of rubble that resembled a landslide one might see in a mountain valley. The sea bottom below the slide was littered with hundreds of chunks of rock and concrete, obviously flung there with great force, most likely by an explosion. Not exactly what I'd call a welcome mat, Austin said. With short, fluttering fin strokes, he swam up the face of the rubble pile. If this was the entrance to the pen, no submarines would be using it soon. He swam back and forth, searching for an opening, but the blockage was complete. Zavala floated up beside him. So much for my dreams of beautiful Russian women. Austin scanned the rubble, then swam over to a slab about 6 feet tall and half as wide that stood like a giant gravestone in a more or less vertical position. A pair of steel rods protruded from the top, like antennae on an insect. If we could topple this slab, maybe we could start a slide that would open up this mess. Not a bad idea. Too bad we forgot to pack dynamite. We may not need it. Remember what Archimedes said? Sure, he's the guy who runs the Greek restaurant down the street. He said, eat here or to go. I'm talking about the other Archimedes.
Oh, that one.
He said, Eureka. He also said, give me a place to stand and I will move the earth. Zavala stared at the steel rods. Archimedes was into levers and fulcrums, as I recall. Eureka, Austin said, swimming up the rock slide until he was above the slab. He squeezed in between the concrete and the cliff, braced his back against the wall, and placed his feet on one of the rods. Zavala took a position beside Austin with his feet on the other rod. Let's see if we can move a small piece of the world, Austin said. On three. They pushed against the rods, and the slab tilted a few inches before settling back into place. The air tanks got in the way, so they adjusted them and tried again. The slab tipped precariously this time. For a moment it seemed as if the block would go over, but despite their shoving and grunting, it rocked back into place. Zavala suggested that they push higher for more leverage. They slid their feet to the ends of the rods, planted their backs, and tried again. This time the slab went over so fast that they almost tumbled down with it. It crashed in slow motion off a big boulder, breaking in half, then bounced a few more times before landing in a muddy cloud. Several other chunks followed it down in a secondary landslide. Crude but effective, Austin said, as he drifted down the face of the pile and stopped in front of a newly created opening in the rubble. He probed the hole with his light, then tried to squeeze through only to have his air tanks get in the way. He removed the tanks. Keeping the regulator in his mouth, he backed into the opening feet first and pulled his tanks in after him. Zavala followed, using the same procedure. They were wedged in a tight space between the pile of boulders and two massive steel blast doors. The armored doors were sealed, but near the top of one was a shadow where the force of the explosion had peeled back a corner, like a page in a book. The gap was big enough for them and their tanks. They slipped through the hole and flashed their lights around. The beams faded into nothingness except for a grayish reflection over their heads. They swam up several feet until their tanks scraped against concrete. Swimming a few feet below the ceiling, they proceeded through the murky water. After a few minutes, the ceiling disappeared, and they swam up until their heads emerged into the open. They were in complete darkness. Austin removed the regulator from his mouth and took a tentative breath. The air was musty, but breathable. They switched on their lights and saw that they were near the edge of a man-made pool. They swam to a ladder, pulled themselves up on the side of the pool and flashed their lights around, probing the perimeter of the rectangular basin. "Hello," Austin murmured. "Someone left their rubber ducky in the bathtub." His light outlined the contours of a submarine on the far side of the pool. They stacked their scuba gear in neat piles for quick retrieval and stripped down to their lightweight black insulated liners. They were traveling light, taking only their weapons, extra ammunition, and lights, and in Austin's case, a belt radio. He tried to call Kamal, but the thick concrete walls made radio contact impossible. Setting off to explore the high-ceiling chamber, they followed a set of narrow-gauge tracks that ran around the pool's perimeter, making their way past fuel pumps and conduits for water and electricity. Gantries and cranes hung from the ceiling to service heavy loads. Sideways traversing machinery could move a sub to the dry side for maintenance. Austin and Zavala went around the pool to where the submarine lay in dry dock. The sub was between 300 and 400 feet long, Austin estimated. They climbed aboard and explored the sub from end to end. The deck behind the conning tower was of the unusual design, long and flat and recessed. They climbed the sail and opened the entry hatch. The stale smell of food, unwashed bodies, and fuel issued from the opening. As the expert on underwater vehicles, Zavala volunteered to go inside the sub while Austin stood watch. A short while later, Zavala emerged. "Nobody home," he said, his voice echoing in the great chamber. "Nothing?" "I didn't say that." Zavala handed Austin a navy baseball cap. "I found this in a bunk room." Austin examined the white lettering on the front of the cap. NR1. "This raises more questions than it answers." "The boat itself is less of a mystery," Zavala said. "It's a diesel, built for a specialized purpose. No torpedoes. She's probably pretty fast on the surface from the looks of her, and those hydroplanes on the sail would give her good maneuverability underwater. The deck is modified to carry something. Cargo. Submersibles, maybe. Something like the NR-1? "Easily. But why block off the entrance doors to the pen? They don't need this baby anymore. What better way to hide the evidence?" "Let's see if we can find the owner of this cap," he said, tucking the cap inside his suit. Satisfied that the sub could yield no further clues, they walked the rest of the way around the pool until they came back to their dive gear. Railroad tracks led to a set of double steel doors about 12 feet high. Next to the doors was an entryway to allow passage without having to open and close the big doors. Zavala tried the handle. "It's unlocked," he said. "We're in luck." "Don't be too sure about that. This may be a case of the spider welcoming the flies." "No problem," Zavala said, fitting the holster to the butt of his Heckler & Koch 9mm VP-70M to form a shoulder stock, giving the pistol the capability of firing 3-round bursts. "I brought spider repellent." Austin slipped his own brand of pesticide out of its leather holster. His Ruger Red Hawk, custom-built by the Bowen Classic Arms Company, was a heavy-duty revolver chambered for the .50 caliber special cartridge. His hand filled with grips made of snake wood, a rare South American wood. The fat barrel was only 4 inches long, but the gun packed a deadly wallop. They opened the door and stepped into a chamber half the size of the subpen. A railroad spur extended from the main chamber. Sitting on the tracks were a half dozen car-sized freight carriers powered by propane. The tracks ran down the center of the room, with tributaries branching out on both sides to a series of arched portals that allowed entrance into side chambers. Entering the nearest room, they found shelves filled with spare parts. The other storerooms contained tools, firefighting equipment, and workshops. One room, separated from the others by a heavy steel blast door, contained demolition charges and small arms. They returned to the main chamber and walked over to an elevator. Next to the elevator was a door that led to a stairwell. The smell of cooked cabbage drifted from above. They climbed the stairs to the next landing and saw light coming from beneath a door that led off the landing. Austin put his ear up to the door and listened. Hearing nothing, he cracked the door a few inches. Then he gently pushed the door open and stepped through, motioning for Zavala to follow. They were in a corridor lit by lights recessed in the ceiling. It was wide enough for four people to walk abreast. The passageway echoed the poured concrete bomb shelter motif of the lower level. Several doors opened off one side. The first led to a cold storage room stocked with meats and vegetables. The cold room was connected to food lockers provisioned with canned goods and groceries. Next to the pantry were a large kitchen and bakery. They moved from the kitchen into the adjacent mess hall, which was furnished with long benches and tables. The smell of cooked food was strong. Austin went over to a table, brushed some crumbs off the top, and dabbed his finger into a circle of water. "Keep a sharp eye out," he said. "Some of the regular customers may still be around." A door led from the mess hall to another passageway and a deserted dormitory fitted out with 50 bunks. The beds were unmade and the footlockers were empty. Next to the dormitory was a small game room with a few tables and chairs. Austin walked over to a chessboard, studied the pieces for a moment, then moved Black Knight to a different square. "Checkmate," he said. With Austin in the lead, they headed back to the main corridor and climbed the stairs to the next floor. In contrast to the Spartan barracks, the floors were covered with thick wall-to-wall carpeting and the walls were paneled in dark wood. They explored half a dozen offices and conference rooms. On the walls were a few yellowed charts, but the desks were cleaned out and the filing cabinets were empty. "This must have been the command post for the submarine base," Austin said. Zavala glanced around the haunted precincts. "It's been a while since they did any commanding. Spooky. Maybe we should call Ghostbusters." Austin grunted. "The guys who shot me out of the air a few days ago weren't made out of ectoplasm." From the command post, they went back to the main passageway, poked into several rooms, each with two beds, that could have been officers' quarters, and followed another connector that led to a large and luxurious suite. The polished oak floors were covered with finely woven oriental rugs. The ornate furniture was made from heavy, dark wood. The decor was a blend of Byzantine and Middle Eastern, with a liberal use of red cloth and gold fringe. Zavala looked at the painting of a voluptuous woman, one of several that decorated the walls. "Remind me when I get home to redo my place in harem modern." Austin was having a problem imagining a bulldog-jowled Soviet sub-commander in the decadent surroundings. "It looks like someone's idea of a Victorian bordello." Despite their bantering, both men were uneasy. Austin recalled the violence that had greeted his first visit to these shores. The quiet gave him the jitters. They explored the rest of the suite, eventually coming to a thick wooden door built with rivets and ornamental straps as if it guarded the portal to a medieval keep. Carved in the door was a large, stylized letter R. Zavala examined the antique keyhole. Then he reached into his pack and pulled out a soft leather case that he unfolded to display an array of lockpicks that would have gotten him arrested in most states. He selected a particularly large pick. "The basic skeleton key should do the job." He ran his fingers over the door carving and strong steel hinges. "There must be something valuable on the other side. I'm surprised they didn't use a better lock." Bending to his task, he inserted the pick in the keyhole, jiggled the tool, then turned it. The lock had been well lubricated, and the deadbolt opened with a loud clunk. Austin put his ear up against the dark wood. Hearing nothing, he tried the ornamental knob. He paused, wondering if hidden cameras had watched them every step of the way into the labyrinth. A gang of cutthroats could be lurking on the other side of the door. The thought of a bullet or dagger in the eye made him squeamish. His lips tightened in a grim smile. Being shot or stabbed in the heart would leave him just as dead as a poke in the eye. Austin couldn't remember who'd said the best defense is a good offense, but he had always considered it good advice. He cocked his bow, motioned to Zavala to back him up, then turned the knob, threw the door open, and stepped inside. Chapter 14. The dented black Lada taxi clattered down the dirt road with every bolt in its ancient chassis rattling in protest. The potholed ruts led through thick pines and ended at an encampment of rustic chalets clustered near the Black Sea. The cab bounced on its worn shock absorbers even after Paul and Gamay Trout extricated themselves from the cramped back seat like clowns in a circus skit. They removed their duffel bags from the roof rack and paid the driver. The cab drove off in a cloud of dust, and the door to a nearby chalet flew open with a bang. A bear-like man charged out, roaring in a voice that practically shook the cones off the trees. "Trout, I can't believe you're here!" He wrapped Paul in a bear hug. "How good to see you, my friend." He pounded Trout on the back. "Good to see you, Vlad," Trout replied, in between the breath-stealing thumps. "This is my wife, Gamay May. Gamay, meet Professor Vladimir Orlov." Orlov extended a ham-sized hand and attempted to click the heels of his rubber sandals together. "A pleasure to meet you, Gamay. Your husband often talked about his brilliant and lovely wife as we drank beer at the Captain Kidd."
"No less than he talked about you, Professor Orlov. Paul has often said how much he enjoyed your time together at Woods Hole."
"We have many fond memories, your husband and I."
He turned to Paul.
"She is as beautiful and charming as I imagined. You are a lucky man."
"Thank you.
And you will be pleased to know that your bar stool awaits your return." "Then it is only a question of when. Tell me how things are at the Oceanographic."
"I was there only a few days ago. I try to get back home in between NUMA assignments. Woods Hole hasn't changed since the year you spent there."
"I envy you. As a pauper nation, Russia is stingy with money for pure scientific research. Even a well-thought-of institution such as Rostov State University must beg for funding. We are fortunate that the government allows the university to use this place as a fieldwork center." Gamay looked around at the rustic cottages and the water sparkling through the trees.
"It's wonderful. Reminds me of the old cottage colonies on the Great Lakes where I grew up."
"The Soviet Navy used it as a getaway for middle-level officers and their wives. There's a tennis court, but the macadam looks like the face of the moon. We've brought in students, and they have done a good job fixing up the chalets. It's perfect for seminars or retreats like this one, where we academics simply come to think."
He grabbed the duffel bags.
"Come, I'll show you where you're staying."
Orlov led the way along a soft pine needle path to a chalet that gleamed with new green and white trim. He climbed onto the porch, dropped the bags, and held the door open for the Trouts. The one-room cottage had up-and-down bunks for four people, a rough-hewn table in the middle, a sink with a pump, and a gas camp stove on the other side. Orlov went to the sink and pumped the handle.
"The water is pure and cold. Be sure to save some in this coffee can to prime the pump. There's a shower outside. The WC is just behind the house. It's a bit primitive, I'm afraid."
Gamay looked around the room.
"Looks quite cozy to me."
Paul said, "We invited ourselves, Professor. We should be grateful we're not sleeping in a tent."
"Nonsense. I'll have no more such talk. You will probably want to unpack and get into something more comfortable."
The professor was wearing baggy black shorts and a red tank top.
"As you see, we're very informal. When you're ready, follow the path back to the main clearing. I'll be waiting with some refreshment."
After Orlov left, they filled the sink and washed up. Gamay traded her stylish cotton slacks and sweater for blue shorts and a t-shirt from the Scripps Oceanographic Institute, where she'd first met Paul, who was studying there. Paul was wearing an L.L. Bean non-wrinkle navy blazer and tan slacks, and one of the wildly colored bow ties he favored. He put on new tan shorts, navy polo shirt, and Teva sandals. Then they strolled back through the pines to the main clearing. Orlov sat at a picnic table in the shade of an arbor. He was talking to a middle-aged couple he introduced as Natasha and Leo Arbikov, both physicists. They spoke little English but communicated with sunny smiles. Orlov said that there were a number of other academicians and students from various fields scattered about in the woods, working on experiments or simply reading. From an oversized cooler, he produced plastic containers of fresh fruit, caviar, smoked fish, cold borscht, a jug of water, and a bottle of vodka. The trouts sampled the food, but drank water, putting off the hard stuff until later. Orlov had no such hesitation, drinking his vodka with apparently little effect. "It helps my concentration," he said with good cheer, washing down a mouthful of caviar. He gave Trout another teeth-rattling pound on the back. "This is so incredible to see you, my friend. I'm glad you called to say you would be in the neighborhood." "It's wonderful to see you again, Vlad, although it was a little difficult getting through to you. We are connected to the outside by a single telephone. That's the beauty of this place. It's the lost world. Only we are the dinosaurs." He roared with laughter at his own joke. "We are paid practically nothing, but we can pursue our work with little in the way of expenses." He lifted the bottle, smacked his lips, and poured himself another two fingers of vodka. "Enough about me. Tell me what brought you to the Black Sea." "You've heard of the Numa research vessel Argo?" "Oh, yes. I've been on her, in fact, a few years ago. She's a wonderful ship. I would expect nothing less from Numa." Paul nodded in agreement. "Gamay and I are doing some research in connection with the Argo's most recent survey. I remembered you were at the university and thought I'd give you a call to let you know we were in the neighborhood." Austin had asked the Trouts to look into Ottoman Industries while he and Zavala checked out the submarine base. Ottoman's headquarters were in the port city of Novorossiysk, on the northeast corner of the Black Sea. Trout immediately thought of Orlov, who had been a visiting professor at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, because he remembered that the professor taught at the university in Rostov, near Novorossiysk. When he'd called Orlov, the professor said he would never forgive Paul if he and Gamay didn't come to visit him. "You had no problem getting here?" the professor inquired. "Not at all. We were lucky to catch a commercial flight to Novorossiysk on short notice. The university arranged for a cab to pick us up at the airport, and here we are." He looked around at the bucolic setting. "Let me get my bearings. We're between Rostov and Novorossiysk?" "That's right. Novorossiysk is the port for the oil fields in the Caucasus. It's also a hero city full of large, ugly monuments commemorating the heroic resistance of the people during the Great Patriotic War." Orlov turned to Gamay. "Paul has lauded your skills as a marine biologist. What sort of work have you been doing?" "Before coming to the Black Sea, I was in the Florida Keys looking at coral damage from industrial runoff." Orlov gave a shake of his head. "It seems that we Russians are not the only environmental barbarians. I am involved in a study of Black Sea pollution." "What about you, Paul?"
"I was at Woods Hole doing some consulting work on a study of ocean mining. I think one of the ocean mining concerns I read about is in Novorossiysk, as a matter of fact."
Guile was not one of Trout's strong suits. He had a blunt, Yankee openness and felt uncomfortable skirting the truth, especially with an old friend. Trout figured that if he threw out a few conversational seeds, one of them would sprout. This seed fell on fertile soil.
"Ocean mining? You must mean Ottoman Industries."
Sounds familiar. I'm sure I read about it somewhere. I'd be surprised if you hadn't. Adaman is huge. They started as a land mining conglomerate, but they saw the potential under the sea, and now their fleet ranges all over the world. Smart move with the worldwide demand for fuel. Yes, that is true, but less commonly known is that Adaman has been in the forefront in devising ways to extract methane hydrate from the sea bottom. I don't remember any mention of that in the corporate literature. Adaman tends to be secretive. Russian capitalism is still in its Wild West phase. We don't have all the disclosure laws your country does. I doubt if they'd make that much difference anyway. With the thousands employed by Adaman, it's very difficult to keep a secret. Adaman has built an entire fleet of monstrous ships that will be used in the extraction of fire ice. Fire ice? Gamay said. It's a term someone came up with for methane hydrate, a compound of methane gas, Paul explained. Pockets of the stuff are trapped under the sea bottom all over the world. Looks like icy snow, only it's flammable. Orlov chimed in. Everyone knows that Soviet scientists claim to have invented everything, from the electric light bulb to the computer, but in this case I must give them credit. The first natural deposits were found in Siberia, where it was known as marsh gas. Some American scientists picked up on the work of our glorious scientists and discovered hydrates under the ocean. Off the South Carolina coast, as I recall, Trout said. Woods Hole did some dives with the deep-water submersible Alvin and found the plumes escaping from the sediment along faults in the ocean floor. What are the commercial applications? Gamay said. Orlov started to pour himself more vodka, thought better of it, and pushed the bottle aside. The potential is enormous. The deposits around the world possibly hold more energy than all the other fossilized fuels combined. You see it as a replacement for oil and gas, then? No less than Scientific American called it the fuel of the future. It could be worth trillions, which is why so many people are interested in its extraction. The technical problems are formidable, though. The substance is unstable and quickly decomposes once it is removed from conditions of extreme depth and pressure. But whoever controls the process may control the future energy supply of the world. Adaman is in the forefront of the exploration and research, Orlov said. His wide brow wrinkled in a worried furrow. Which is not good. Why not? Paul asked. Adaman is owned in its entirety by an ambitious businessman named Mikhail Ratsov. He must be fabulously wealthy, Gamay said. It goes beyond the riches. Ratsov is a complex man. While he keeps his business dealings shrouded in secret, his public persona looms quite large in Russia. He has been outspoken in his criticism of the way things are being run in Moscow, and has gained a substantial cult following. A tycoon with political ambitions is not unusual, even in the United States, Gamay said. We've often elected rich men as governors, senators, presidents. Well, God help us if we put someone like Ratsov in power. He's a nationalist zealot who talks only of restoring the good old days. I thought communism was dead. Oh, it is. Only to be replaced by another form of oligarchy. Ratsov believes Russia achieved its greatest glories under the rule of the czars. Peter the Great, Ivan the Terrible. He's not clear on the specifics, which is what frightens many people. He says only that he wants to see the spirit of the old empire embodied in the new Russia. Guys like him come and go, Paul said. I hope so. But this time, I'm not so sure. He has a magnetic quality, and his simplistic message has struck a chord in my poor country. Is Adaman a city or region? Gamay said. Orlov smiled.
It's a Russian term for a Cossack chieftain. Ratzov is a Cossack by birth, so I suppose he fancies himself as the company's chief. He spends most of his time on a magnificent yacht. It's called Kazachestvo. Loosely translated, it stands for Cossackism. The whole bloody chest-thumping exercise. You should see it. A floating palace a few miles from here. Orlov displayed his gold teeth. But enough of politics. We have more pleasant things to talk about. First, I must excuse myself. I have some unavoidable work I must attend to. It will take only an hour or two, then I will be completely free. In the meantime, you might like to sun yourself on the beach. I'm sure we can find something to do. Splendid. He got up, shook hands with Trout, and embraced Kameh. I will see you back here later this afternoon, and we will talk all night. The middle-aged couple also took their leave, and the Trouts were left alone. Paul suggested that they inspect the beach. The deep blue sea was a short walk from the camp. A lone swimmer was paddling around about 100 feet out. The beach was stony and not conducive to sunbathing, and the metal beach chairs were as hot as grills to the touch. While Gamay looked for a place to stretch out, Paul walked down the beach. He came back a few minutes later. I found something interesting, he said, and led the way around a bend, where a powerboat was drawn up on shore. The white paint was peeling on the wooden hull, but the boat looked sound enough. The outboard motor was a Yamaha in good condition, and there was gas in the tank. Gamay read her husband's mind. Are you thinking of taking a spin? Trout shrugged and glanced off at a young man of college age who was coming out of the water. Let's ask this guy if it's okay. They went over to the swimmer, who had come to shore and was toweling himself dry. When they said hello, the young man smiled. You're the Americans? Paul nodded and introduced himself and Gamay. My name is Yuri Orlov, the Russian said. You know my father. I'm a student at the university. He spoke English with an American accent. They shook hands all around. Yuri was tall and gangling, about 20 years old, with a shock of straw-colored hair over his forehead and big blue eyes magnified by horn-rimmed glasses. We were wondering if it would be possible to take a spin in the boat, Paul said. No problem, Yuri said, beaming. Anything for friends of my father. He pushed the boat out to where the water was deeper and gave the cord a pull. The motor coughed, but didn't start. This motor has an attitude, he said in apology. He rubbed his hands together, then adjusted the fuel mixture and tried again. This time the motor sputtered and snarled before smoothing out. The Trouts got in the boat, and Yuri gave it a push, jumped aboard, and pointed the boat out to sea. Chapter 15. Austin's eyes took a few seconds to adjust to the dimness. The pungent fragrance of incense evoked the image of an ancient Byzantine chapel in a monastery he had visited high on a hill at Mystra, overlooking the Greek city of Sparta. Gaslight flickered in brass lanterns of ornate gold and stained glass that were set into sconces in rough plaster walls, covered with brilliantly painted icons. The vaulted ceiling was reinforced with thick wooden ribs. A high-backed chair faced an altar at the far end of the room. They moved in for a closer look. The altar was draped with a dark purple cloth stitched in gold with the letter R. On top of the altar was a smoking incense burner. Set in the wall above the altar was a lamp whose yellow light illuminated a large black-and-white photograph in an ornate gold frame. 7 people were pictured in the photograph. From the facial resemblance they shared, the 2 adults and 5 young people appeared to be posing for a family portrait. Standing on the left side was a bearded man wearing a military-style visored cap and a ceremonial military uniform trimmed with fancy piping. Medals adorned his chest. A thin, pale-faced young boy in a sailor suit stood in front of the man. Next to the boy were 3 girls in their teens and another girl slightly younger, all gathered around a seated, middle-aged woman.
The children's features combined their father's wide forehead and the broad face of their mother. In the foreground was a low column like those used for museum display. Resting on top of it was a magnificent crown. The crown was massive and obviously not designed to be worn for very long. It was heavily encrusted with rubies, diamonds, and emeralds. Even in the black and white photograph, the gemstones crowding the surface glittered as if they were on fire. A two-headed gold eagle surmounted the globe. "That little bauble must be worth something," Zavala said. He leaned closer and studied the somber faces. They looked so unhappy. "They could have had a premonition of what awaited them," Austin said. He ran his hand over the embroidered altar cover. "R, as in Romanov." He glanced around the funereal chamber. "This is a shrine to the memory of Tsar Nicholas II and his family. The boy in the picture would have been in line to wear that crown if he and his family hadn't been murdered." Austin plunked into the chair facing the altar, and as he leaned back, a deep chorus of male voices poured from hidden speakers. The religious chanting welled throughout the chamber and echoed off the walls. Austin shot out of the chair like a jack-in-the-box, his revolver at the ready. The haunting music stopped. Zavala saw the look of alarm on his partner's face and stifled a laugh. "A bit jumpy, my friend." "Cute," Austin said. He pressed his hand against the back of the chair and the chanting resumed. It stopped when he removed his hand. A pressure-activated switch turns on the tunes. It gives a whole new meaning to the term musical chair. Care to try it?
No, thanks.
My musical taste runs more to salsa. Remind me to rig a Barca lounger up to my collection of progressive jazz. Austin glanced at the door. We're done here. Even a rat wouldn't be dumb enough to be caught in a trap like this. They left the somber confines of the Romanov shrine and returned to the staircase they had climbed from the submarine pen. They went up another level and found themselves in a barracks similar to the one below. Whereas the lower dormitory was neat, here blankets were bunched on the dirty mattresses as if thrown there in a hurry. Cigarette butts and plastic cups littered the floor. There was the stale smell of sweat and rotting food.
"Phew," Zavala said.
Austin wrinkled up his nose. "Look on the bright side. We won't need bloodhounds to pick up the trail." They followed a wide corridor that slanted upward like the ramp in an underground parking garage. After a few minutes, fresh air blew against their faces, replacing the foul odor emanating from the barracks. Natural light coming from a bend in the passageway began to fill in the spaces between the puddles of illumination from overhead bulbs spaced in the ceiling. The passageway ended in a steel door that had been left ajar. A short ramp led to the interior of what appeared to be a warehouse or a garage. The concrete floor was stained with oil and spotted with the droppings of small animals. Austin picked an old, yellowed copy of Pravda out of a pile of rubbish. The beetle-browed face of Leonid Brezhnev glowered from the front page. Austin tossed the newspaper aside and went over to a window. Not a shard of glass remained in the metal frame, giving him an unimpeded view of several nearby steel structures. The warehouse was part of the complex of abandoned buildings Austin had first seen from the air. The corrugated exteriors were streaked with rust, and the seams on the walls and roofs had buckled with age. Concrete walks linking the complex were overgrown with tall grass. Zavala caught Austin's attention with a sharp whistle. He was looking out from the opposite side of the warehouse. Working his way around the rubbish, Austin crossed over and peered through the window. The warehouse sat on a rise overlooking a large, weed-grown field that was roughly rectangular in shape and depressed a few feet like a giant soap dish. The rusty framework of a soccer goal jutted from the grass at one end. Austin guessed that the area had once been an athletic field used for R&R by visiting submarine crews. Now, horsemen were strung out along the perimeter of the field on three sides. Only the side nearest the warehouse and the other buildings was open. Austin recognized the gray tunics and black pants worn by the gang of Cossacks that had shot him out of the sky. There were at least three times as many riders, now all facing into the field.
"You never told me this was a polo club," Zavala said, in a bad imitation of a British accent.
"I wanted to surprise you," Austin said, focusing on a frightened-looking group of people huddled in the center of the field. "We're in time for the last chucker. Follow me and I'll introduce you to the chaps I met the last time I was here."
Austin and Zavala slipped out of the warehouse, dropped to their hands and knees, and wriggled snake-style until they came to the edge of the field where the grass thinned out. Austin pushed aside the grass for a better look as three horsemen broke away from the others, one from each side. With a series of blood-curdling yells, the Cossacks galloped toward the huddled people, then broke off their charge at the last second and circled like Apaches attacking a wagon train. With each pass, they came closer. The horses kicked up fountains of dirt, and the riders leaned out of their saddles and brought their whips down in slashing blows. Austin quickly figured out the one-sided rules of the game. The Cossacks were trying to break the group apart so they could run them to ground individually. The field had been left unguarded on one side to tempt someone to make a break for freedom. But the strategy wasn't working. With each charge, their prey bunched closer together, like zebras being stalked by hungry lions. Yelping loudly, the riders galloped back to the edge of the field and took their place in line again. Austin expected another attack, maybe with more riders. Instead, a lone horseman broke from the ranks and put his mount into a trot as if he were out for a Sunday ride. Austin shielded the binocular lenses with his hands to prevent the sun from reflecting. The rider was dressed in the familiar mud-colored belted tunic, baggy black pants and boots, and fur hat, although the day was warm. Cartridge belts crossed his chest. He rode a big, dark gray horse with wide flanks and shoulders like a draft animal. Austin studied the man's long, unkempt red beard and let out an evil chuckle. The last time he'd seen the giant Cossack was over the barrel of a flare gun. "Well, well, we meet again." "Is that clean-cut chap a friend of yours?" Zavala said. "More a passing acquaintance. We had a glancing encounter not too long ago." Taking his time, the Cossack put his mount into a parade strut and circled the field, showing off for the other horsemen, who cheered him on. Then he drew his saber, raised it high, and let out a hoarse yell. Digging his spurs into his mount, he charged toward the center of the field like a bowling ball rolling down on tenpins. At the last second, he brought the horse to a skidding stop and pulled back on the reins. The big horse reared up on its hind legs and pawed the air. The people huddled in the field scrambled to avoid the flailing hooves and to escape the crushing weight of the giant animal. In the confusion, one man tripped and fell and became separated from the others. He got up and tried to regain the relative safety of the pack, but the Cossack saw the opening and wedged his horse between. The man fainted to the right and made a dash to the left. The Cossack anticipated the move and herded the man like a cowpoke culling out a steer for branding. Seeing no alternative, the man sprinted for the unguarded side of the field. The runner's face was set in a determined expression, even though he must have known his two legs were no match for the horse's four. The Cossack made no move to give chase and continued to put his strutting mount through its paces for the benefit of his comrades. Not until the runner was halfway to the edge of the field did the rider wheel his horse around. He spurred his horse into a trot, then into a ground-eating canter. Raising his sword again, he urged his mount into a full gallop. Alerted by the pounding hoofbeats, the runner thrust his chest out like a sprinter at the finish line and pumped his arms to wring out the last ounce of speed. No use. As the horse thundered by him, the Cossack leaned over to one side and the sword swept down in a killing blow to the neck. The runner's legs crumbled and he slammed face first into the ground. Austin swore with helpless anger. The cowardly attack had come too fast for him to react. The Cossack laughed at his cleverness and wheeled his mount around, then rode leisurely back to the center of the field, daring someone else to make a run for it. Austin brought the bowen up and sighted on the Cossack's broad back.
He was squeezing the trigger when he caught movement out of the corner of his eye. To Austin's amazement, the figure slumped on the ground and began to stir. The runner got onto his hands and knees and staggered to his feet. The Cossack had only toyed with his prey, using the flat of his sword so as to extend the game. The Cossacks began shouting. Redbeard pretended that he didn't understand, then turned and went through a great show of being surprised. He waved his arms as if he were nonplussed at his victim rising from the dead. Then once more, he gave chase. The runner was almost to the edge of the field. Austin knew that the Cossack would never let his prey reach the buildings where it would be difficult to get at him. The next sword blow would be lethal. Zavala had lost his patience. "Game's over," he snarled. Bringing his heckler and cock up in the classic prone shooting position, he sighted on the Cossack's chest. Austin put his hand on the barrel and said no. Then he stood up. When the runner saw Austin spring from the earth, his sweat-streaked face fell in dismay. Seeing his escape route cut off, he jammed his heels in and came to a skidding stop. Redbeard saw Austin at the same time. He reined in his horse, leaned forward on the pommel, and stared at the broad-shouldered man with the strange pale hair. Austin could see the hate burning in the red-rimmed eyes. The horse snorted and nervously pawed the ground. Losing interest in the runner, the Cossack sat up in his saddle and put his horse into a pirouette. Then he made a false charge, only to retreat when Austin showed no sign of yielding ground. Austin had been standing with his hands behind his back like a child hiding cookies. He brought his left hand out and beckoned. The horseman's puzzled frown turned into a gap-toothed grin. He liked this new game. He edged his mount closer, still wary. Austin beckoned again with more animation. Emboldened, the horseman came nearer. Austin smiled, like Davy Crockett grinning down a grizzly. The horseman let out a roar and goaded his mount forward. Still smiling, Austin waited until he couldn't miss. Then in a smooth, fluid motion, he brought the bowen from behind his back. Holding the heavy revolver in both hands, he sighted on the X made by the Cossack's crossed cartridge belts. "Here's one from Mehmet," he said, squeezing the trigger. The revolver barked once. The heavy bullet smashed into the rider's sternum and splintered his rib cage, sending fragments of bone into his heart. The Cossack was dead even before his hands lost their grip on the reins. The horse continued toward Austin like a runaway cement mixer, its eyes rolling in panic. Austin cursed himself for not getting down to business and firing sooner. Spooked by the human standing in its way and with no signal coming from the slack reins, the animal veered off. Its rock-hard haunch swung around, slammed into Austin with the force of a battering ram, and knocked him off his feet. He flew through the air and crashed to the turf with a teeth-rattling shock, landing on his left side. When he stopped rolling, he tried to stand but only made it up onto one knee. He was covered with dust and wet on one side from horse sweat. Zavala was by Austin's side, helping him to his feet. As Austin's blurred vision cleared, he expected to see the Cossacks bearing down on them. Instead, the world seemed frozen in time and place. Stunned by their leader's fall, the horsemen sat in their saddles like statues in a park. The people in the field were equally immobilized. Austin spat out a mouthful of dirt. Slowly and deliberately, he walked over to where his gun had landed and picked it up. He yelled at the runner and told him to go for the warehouse. The order shocked the man into action. He started to run. It was as if a power switch had been thrown. Seeing their friend break for safety, the men in the field bolted after him in a disorganized mob. Austin and Zavala yelled encouragement and pointed to the warehouse. With their leader dead and their prey escaping, the Cossacks yelled as one, poured into the soccer field, and advanced at a gallop, sabers held high, toward Austin and Zavala. The two men stood there in awe at the fearful beauty of a Cossack charge. "Wow," Zavala shouted over the thunder of hooves. It's like being in an old western.
Let's hope it isn't a remake of Custer's Last Stand, Austin said with a thin smile.
Austin brought his bow up and fired. The lead rider pitched from his saddle. Zavala's H&K stuttered, and another horseman crashed to the ground. The riders advanced without slackening their pace, well aware they held the advantage in numbers and momentum. The guns fired simultaneously, and two more men flew from their saddles. The Cossacks were bold but not suicidal. First one, then another, leaned out of his saddle and hung from his horse's neck so he no longer offered an easy target. As Austin and Zavala adjusted to the new strategy, one horse came to a sudden stop, dropped to the ground, and rolled onto its side. Austin thought the animal had stumbled. Then he saw that the rider was firing at them, using his mount as a protective barricade. Other riders followed suit. Those Cossacks still in their saddles split up, coming in from both sides in a pincher movement. Austin and Zavala hit the ground and dug in. Bullets flew over their heads like angry bees.
Automatic weapons, Zavala yelped. You said these guys carried blunderbusses and pig stickers.
How would I know they'd stop off at a gun show?
Whatever happened to background checks?
Austin's reply was drowned out by the stutter of automatic arms fire. He and Zavala let off a couple of rounds more for show than effect, then pulled back from the rise and crawled toward the warehouse. The Cossacks peppered the ridge with gunfire. Thinking their prey was dead, they climbed onto their horses and took up the charge where they had left off. From the shelter of the warehouse, Austin and Zavala aimed through the windows, and two more riders toppled from their mounts. Seeing that their foe was still alive, the Cossacks called off the attack and galloped to the center of the field to regroup. Taking advantage of the momentary battle lull, Austin turned from the window and surveyed the men who had taken refuge. Austin couldn't remember when he'd seen a more bedraggled-looking bunch. Their tan jumpsuits were wrinkled and begrimed, and their hollow-eyed faces bristled with whiskers. The first runner, who had felt the direct wrath of the Cossack leader, came over to speak with Austin. His uniform was torn at the knees and elbows and covered with dust. Yet he kept his chin as high as if he were wearing newly pressed dress whites on parade. The young man gave Austin a crisp salute. Ensign Stephen Kreisman of the U.S. Navy submarine NR-1. Austin reached under his belt where he had tucked the cap Zavala found on the Russian submarine. Maybe you can get this back to its owner, he said, handing the cap over.
It's the captain's.
Where did you get this? Kreisman said, looking at the cap as if he were seeing it for the first time. My partner found it in a Russian sub.
Who are you guys? Kreisman said, losing his aplomb.
I'm Kurt Austin, and that's my partner Joe Zavala at the window. We're with the National Underwater and Marine Agency. The ensign's jaw dropped down to his Adam's apple. With their battle-hardened eyes and smoking guns, the two who had rescued him and his crew looked more like commandos than ocean scientists.
I didn't know NUMA had its own SWAT team, he said with wonder.
We don't. Are you okay? I feel as if I've been run over by a bulldozer, but other than that, I'm fine, he said, rubbing his neck where the saber had whacked him. I won't be wearing a tie for a while. This may sound like a dumb question, Mr. Austin, but what are you and your friend doing here?